This episode of Sacktown Talks is brought to you by Elk Grove Power Sports, California's premier power sport dealer. Elk Grove Power Sports has the brands you know and trust like Can-Am, Vespa, Sea-Doo, Moto Guzzi, and many others. They offer easy financing and take trade-ins too. Stop daydreaming about that recreational vehicle you've had your eye on and schedule your test drive today. More information at egpowersports.com. This episode is also brought to you by ESAC BJJ, Sacramento's newest Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy. Each one of my students is a working professional, a full-time student, a mother, or a father. My students balance many commitments to make time to practice BJJ, which is why I am committed to fostering a positive and inclusive environment. Adult classes as low as $75 a month, and we offer children's classes too. More information at esacbjj.com.
See you there. 3, 2, 1. What's up? I'm here with Ezra David Romero. Ezra Romero, host of Yosemite Land Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I was really interested in talking to you, so I feel like you're kind of like the new kid on the block in terms of like the reporters around Sacramento. Love what you're doing on Capital Public Radio as an environmental reporter. And then you further earned my admiration when you jumped on Yosemite Land. You know, I think it's so cool what we can do with this podcast format to bring people, I don't know, I would call almost like a la carte sort of entertainment. It's like, oh, I got 15 minutes, I got 17, 20 minutes to fill up, I don't know, on a drive somewhere. The radio isn't doing it for me today. Maybe I can explore a topic that I'm uniquely interested in. Hey, I can pull up Yosemite Land. Hey, I can pull up the Joe Rogan Experience. Hey, I can pull up whatever, you know?
Totally.
Yeah. So what gave you the idea? Like, was it your idea? What gave you sort of like the...
Like, for Yosemite Land?
Yeah.
Well, I covered Yosemite for about 5 years for Valley Public Radio in Fresno. Yosemite was in our coverage area as well. So I had all this experience and history there as a kid growing up near Yosemite. And then they had wanted me to do a podcast for the station, and so I had gave some couple ideas, and I pitched just some stories about Yosemite and Tahoe and the mountain areas. And so my editor was like, why don't you do a podcast on Yosemite? Like, everyone loves that place. You know, you have all this experience with it, and, you know, you can make it personal, and you can talk about some of the stories about Yosemite that are more than like the top 10 places to hike and like how to go up Half Dome with cables and things like that. I can talk about other things.
Yeah. Just all that stuff that's been done to death. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's, I did go up Half Dome on cable just this last summer. I posted a picture of my wife and I, and, you know, I didn't think we were going to make it up actually. Cause you know, the sub dome is so much harder to get up.
Yeah.
And by the time you get up the sub dome, you're so exhausted. And then the top of the dome is looking at you like this.
It's daunting, eh?
It's super daunting. You know, I'm not afraid of heights, but I'm afraid of that. You know, and we got, and my wife was like, she was crying almost to parts of the sub dome. You know, her feet hurt. My skin was coming off the bottom of my feet, you know. But we made it up, and it was like one of the most beautiful experiences of my life looking back. You know, The actual trip up, I didn't particularly enjoy. You know,
yeah, it's I've actually never done Half Dome.
Oh yeah, mm-mm. Yeah, you should do it. It's you know, there's two ways to do it, right? You can do it, you know, in one go, and it's like a 13 to 16 hour type of deal, or you can hike up to the saddle, spend the night, hike up the dome, and then spend the night on the way down as well. It's like kind of a 2 or 3 day deal.
Sure.
And it's way.
A lot of my friends have done the camping thing where you go halfway camp and then.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so chill, man. The folks who did that, cause you know, you talk to people on the way up and down, the folks who did that, seem to have enjoyed themselves a lot more, you know? Hey, so what was the process of recording Yosemite Land? Like, did you spend like a week in the Valley? Did they put you up somewhere? How'd that work?
Yeah. So I had a bunch of reporting already done from last year when I did a series on Yosemite and on affordable housing. So I had a bunch of stuff that I already had done. But then I went back for about 8 days and I stayed at a hotel near Yosemite and interviewed a bunch of people that I had set up interviews with. And then I went back a second time for another week and did a bunch more interviews. So I just was up there interviewing a lot of people. And then I came back. And started putting my ideas together and said, I think I have these topics for these episodes. And then I started writing them, putting them together, cutting all the audio, sorting through, like, I don't know, 50 hours of audio or so to tell these 15 to 20 minute stories.
Yeah, I thought that was so cool. Like the creation process for you and I is a little bit different, right? Like I'm I mean, you and I are just talking and I'm going to put this up, right? Whereas like Yosemite Land, you kind of have like maybe these like core themes that you want to hit on. And then as people hit on them, you kind of like, okay, here. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, so I went into it already having done pre-interviews and things like that. So I sort of knew who I was going to include in each story. So the first one was called Selfie Trap, right? And it was all about commercialization and how, you know, our influence there is changing the park, right? So I did interviews with like the public information officers there, professors who are studying selfie culture in the park when it comes to like Instagram and things, and then groups that are trying to bring young people into the park who are trying to change it in a different way, right? So I kind of went into all those interviews already knowing I was going to use them in some way, and sort of like coming up with like dream tape, as we call it, like, okay, I want this to happen on this trip, I kind of want to steer the conversation in this way, or maybe they're going to blow my mind and say something entirely different that I'm going to use. Like in our first episode, I went out on this with this group called Nature Bridge. They bring like young high schoolers out in the wild, and while we were out there,
from diverse
backgrounds and things.
Hey, quick shout out to Alfredo Arredondo, who's doing Latino Outdoors. You know, it's so important. Not to cut you off, I'm so sorry, but he does advocacy for the, you know, for these groups that are, you know, fighting to diversify everything from outdoor hiking trails to the beach to, you know, go snowboarding in Tahoe and tell me how many, you know, faces of color you see on the ski lifts, you know. So Alfredo, stay righteous.
Sorry, God. No, it's okay. And so on that trip, we saw a bear, right? So then we included all that bear scene in the story. And I didn't know I was going to see a bear with these kids and get their reactions, but we that happened just while we were walking, and so we included it, right? And then all that became Selfie Trap.
I did a little bit of that. Actually, we took a selfie stick, and that became our flashlight on a trip up Half Dome.
Oh yeah,
we started at we started at like 3 a.m you know, and till sunrise was about 6, and so we were just using the flashlight on our cell phone, and I was using the selfie stick to kind of guide my way along.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of like a dream actually, because all you can just see kind of like this much in front of you.
And you just like used your phone, or?
Yeah, I used my phone, and my wife used let me tell you, man, these phones, because we had headlamps, the phones were as bright as the headlamps. And what's nice about using the phone was that if I have the headlamp and I turn to look at my wife, I just flashed her in her eyes.
Yeah, you're not blinding her.
Yeah, I'm not blinding her. So the phone was actually, it worked out really nicely. But I was kind of having a little anxiety attack for the first 3 hours, at least when it was dark, because I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to run into a bear here. I'm gonna run into it, and it wasn't until later on that I read that there'd never actually, I think, been a bear fatality in Yosemite Park.
Yeah, and most black bears are scared of humans.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and we saw one on the way down. You get a sense for how strong they are. You know, what it was on this log, and it was just like ripping the log open to get out like the grubs and stuff inside. You know.
Yeah.
The last episode, I think episode 6 was about the fires.
Yes, we're still going. Episode 6 this week was about the Hetch Hetchy in Yosemite.
Yeah.
And then a bus ride throughout the valley, talking about multiple topics.
Got it. You were talking about the fires in Yosemite and how fire can be a sort of an agent of renewal.
Yeah.
And that had actually been released like right prior to fire season, hadn't it? And I thought that was like really topical.
Yeah, it was actually just happened while that big fire was happening in Yosemite, the Ferguson fire.
Yeah.
We were going to actually use a lot of that content for an episode about climate change in the park.
Yeah.
But then we ended up pulling that and using it in sort of like an emergency episode in some way, right? Because the big fire was happening and Yosemite Valley was closed. So it was sort of a perfect time to talk about fire. And I had already interviewed Yosemite's fire chief, Kelly Martin, and a UC Merced professor, Leroy Westerling, about he deals with climate change, and he predicts fire and how fire is going to move across the landscape, looking at like 10 to 100 to 500 years into the future.
Yeah.
So it was kind of perfect. We just paired those two voices together, and then we talked to a colleague of mine, Bob Moffitt, who grew up in Mariposa. Yeah. And so we talked about what it was like for him to grow up in a fire area. And he went up there to cover the fire a little bit as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, that was the last one I listened to. It's like really topical. So it's like, oh, we just went through this. And then my own personal friend, Joy Pendle, I actually put her on the podcast. I felt like what she went through was sort of relevant to Sacramento in general. She has a, you know, you might be interested in talking to her, actually. I don't know. But she owns a queen bee breeding operation.
Oh, cool.
And so she's, you know, she's impacted by bee mortality. And she can just talk your ear off about
it. Yeah, I've written about bee mortality a lot.
Yeah, yeah. In the past. She's crazy, man. She took all our, she took our group of friends up to her ranch and just kind of showed us the you know, the business of harvesting queens, harvesting, you know, bees. We're all like in these bee suits and she's just, you know, she's just in a tank top, you know, because she's so used to it.
Yeah, the last story I did about bees, I didn't even have anything on. I just was out there with my mic.
You just raw dogged it.
Yeah. Well, the guy was like, you know, the bees were just, you know, they're interested in like doing their thing and they're not going to bother you unless you bother them. And so,
yeah,
they did like my microphone because I guess they like the color black. Oh, or really? They don't like it, I guess. It seems threatening or something. And so they're trying to get at my microphone. But
did you get some cool audio of them, like kind of buzzing on the
mic? Yeah, yeah. A lot of that stuff.
That's cool. Yeah. So she was up in Stony Ford, which is like kind of like an hour and a half sort of northwest, kind of by Chico. But her family homestead had been threatened by the car fire. And she dodged a number of barricades to get back home from Sacramento. And she was like, all right, time to play your own firefighter. They take the dozer, cut lines across the, you know, and around the family ranch, take the dozer, pull out all the trees, you know, set up irrigation lines, set up, you know, new, you know, firefighting lines, and just kind of bunker down and hope this thing doesn't come. You know, they made it out. No problem. But it's, kind of harrowing, you know, what people, you know, that really reminded me of what Bob Moffitt was saying. It's like, hey, you know, if we live on the top of a mountain and there's fire coming up the side of a mountain, they don't catch it, we're in trouble, you know, you're in big trouble, you know. So what I've noticed in the last year that sort of Capital Public Radio has been pivoting towards podcasts and this sort of like a la carte entertainment model. What are your thoughts on the medium? What are your thoughts on why they're doing that and sort of how, I mean, it seems like everyone has a podcast now. So again, thanks for taking the time. But yeah, it seems like everyone has a podcast now. What's the power of the median in your view, and why, what's the sort of like the strategic initiative from Capital Public Radio's point of view?
Capital Public Radio is trying to invest in podcasts, right? So they had a number, they had 5 podcasts this year and they're going to have more next year.
Yeah.
Maybe one for me. I don't know. We'll find out if I pitch an idea and they like it, but yeah, they want to invest in that landscape, right? You know, people are, I think, I don't know necessarily how many people are listening to podcasts overall, but, or who's, this transition of who's listening to radio, like my generation is probably not listening to the radio as much, right?
Yeah.
So I get a lot of listeners to the podcast that don't listen to Capital Public Radio, right? Or my friends who don't listen to NPR or any talk radio that will listen to a podcast, something about a niche thing, you know,
yeah,
because, you know, they'll listen to it at the gym or on their bike or on a road trip and things like that. It's like we're just reaching a different audience, and it's, for us, it's a different way to tell stories, right, in a different place, right? And these stories can air on the radio, they can air in podcast form, but it's pretty cool. This is my second podcast I've done. I had one at my old station called Outdoorsy, where we just did a bunch of adventure sports, and I'd go whitewater rafting and record the experience and talk about what you need and talk to experts, things like that.
Cool. What other type of sports did you do?
We did backpacking, rock climbing, spelunking.
Oh, cool.
We did 10 episodes, 10 different things.
That's so cool. Did you have like a favorite one?
I really liked the rock climbing episode, and I also really loved the whitewater rafting one. Was really fun to record and be part of. And then I really like the caving one where we got to like go look at a cave system and
go like spelunking's like underwater cave diving, right?
Actually, we didn't just spelunk. We just went caving.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
We
just went to this cave and learned all about caving and how to do it and like what to be careful about. And it was really cool.
Any cave is more cave than I need. Let me tell you, man. I went camp. Do you know Hip Camp?
Yeah.
Yeah, so
that app.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's like Airbnb for camping. If you have like, you know, if you have your 20 acres out in the middle of nowhere, or out in this case Placerville, And so we stayed with this lovely older couple, and their thing was, they have their little homestead, and then kind of like they have these rolling hills, and on the other side of the rolling hills, they have like all these private campgrounds. And at nighttime you come down and kind of hang out with them. They built a brick pizza oven.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. The guy poured its own foundation, 'cause it's like 8,000 pounds of brick and hay, and like, it's old school, man. He did it himself.
Dang.
We were talking from about 6 to 10 p.m. with these. It was just so cool. It was just such an experience to, like, kind of meet and connect with other people. But at around 9:30 or so, he's like, hey, you know, there's a bunch of kind of DIY'd mine shafts dug out here, kind of, you know, unmapped. And I'm like, no way. And he's like, yeah, you know, it's gold country. And I'm like, well, he's like, you guys want to see one? And I'm going to my wife. I'm like, I don't want to see one. I don't need to see a mine shaft, you know? And then she's like, yeah, let's see one. And then like all the other people in the group are like, yeah, let's see one. He's like, yeah, cool. It's a 10-minute walk. And so he walks us out to the side of this mountain. You can see where they axed into the mountain, and it's about 4 feet tall.
Wow.
And he's like, all right, guys, so here's the deal. All of you kind of wait outside the mine shaft. Wait kind of to the left, because sometimes bear or a mountain lion will kind of den in there. I'm going to run in there and scare it away. If it runs out, it'll run straight out. But just kind of wait to the left. Don't get in front of it. I'm like, oh, man, this is real.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to go in there if it was a mountain lion.
Yeah, yeah. So he went in first. There's nothing in there. But you could see there was a place where there was an animal, denning in there for sure. And it's about 4 feet tall. And we kind of have to go down like this. And, oh, my God, I just kept imagining it caving in on me. But my wife wanted to go, and I wasn't going to let her die alone in there, you know. So we went. But yeah, man, that's so, so cool. I really like, this idea of sort of experiencing outdoors with other people and connecting other people to it, you know, and that's sort of, I think, one of the core thematic elements of Yosemite and Yosemite Land is like, you know, in order for this to be a public resource that is stewarded by our country, by our nation, you know, by the state of California in trust for the people. There's like this delicate balance that you touched on of like throughput. You know, you got to get people in, have the experience, and get them out.
Yeah.
As quickly as possible, right?
There's just a bottleneck there of how many people are visiting, right? Mm. The public information officer, Scott Gedeman, said, and I think in the first episode, it's like, it's not that we can't handle the amount of people. Like, we can actually handle that amount of people, 4 to 5 million people a year. It's just the amount of cars that are coming in, right?
Yeah.
You know, the valley wasn't originally destined or made to handle that many cars, right? So there's not enough parking, and then you have to balance how to fill up those 2,000 parking spots, and then what if there's 1,000 more cars every day, you know? So it's a delicate balance, and it's, I think in this last episode I talk about how, despite all the traffic, I think it's still worth visiting Yosemite Valley. It's just beautiful, awesome place. Yeah. That's totally worth it, that you can only have these kinds of experiences at.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that traffic is real, man. On this trip, we went in at 3 a.m., so it's no problem. But we did a pre-trip. We did the trip, her and I, to get up the dome, but we also did, about 2 months earlier, we did a trip, her and I and her kids. One, to take the kids, and two, to sort of, you know what to expect.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, the Mist Trail, just kind of get an idea for it. And so we travel around everywhere in the truck with a portable grill and just an ice locker full of food. And we're thinking, God, we'd love to like pull over somewhere and just cook up some food and, you know, tailgate in the back of this truck. And so we go up to that parking lot. We go up to that parking lot that has like a perfect view of the falls. And I'm like, you know what? Let's just hang out here till we get a spot. And what do you know? It was like 45 minutes, but we finally got a spot. We were able to tailgate, make a little food, like in full view of the falls, in full view of El Capitan, in full view of Half Dome, and you know, it's a memory that I'll never forget. But let me tell you, man, getting out of there, and then getting up the first half of the Mist Trail. You know, how about that, right? Just falling over each other,
Yeah, there's tons of people in and out of there. I actually haven't done that trail in a long time because of that.
Yeah.
Just the amount of people that are on it.
Yeah, it puts people off, right?
Yeah.
I remember I was whitewater rafting with Michael Picker, who's the president of the Public Utilities Commission. He'd kind of taken his staff out on a whitewater rafting. and we're like in this like really scenic and picturesque sort of landscape. You know, we're whitewater rafting, and there's these like two or three rafts in front of us, and a couple people in our raft are commenting. They're saying, "Gosh, I wish they'd get out of our scene. Like, I wish, you know, we would have stayed back a little bit so we wouldn't have to see the scene with them." And I thought to myself, huh, that's an interesting take on it. I think it's kind of cool that we're all doing it together. You know, I kind of liked seeing that. It's like, hey, like we're all conquering the, you know, we're all children of God playing in Eden's garden, you know?
Yeah. It's just your, it's all your view on it, right? Like I go to Yosemite Valley, but I often try to go in areas where I know there's not going to be a lot of people, do a trail that might be harder with my buddies that we just know there's not going to be as many people on, or go to an area of the park that's just different altogether to get away from the crowds.
Yeah.
You know, just because I know what I'm in for. And it depends on what I'm doing. Like if I'm taking people that have been there the first time, we'll go to all the popular spots and deal with all the people. It's not a big deal. It's just expectations, right?
Yeah.
But if I'm going for myself, I'm not, probably won't even go to Yosemite Valley. I'll probably go somewhere else.
Hetch Hetchy.
In the Hetch Hetchy or Tuolumne Meadow, somewhere in the park. There's a lot of other places, you know, like most of the park is not Yosemite Valley.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, so you're about 10 months into your tenure here in Sacramento.
Yeah, I started at the end of November last year.
Yeah. So, and you were previously at Valley Public Radio in Fresno.
Yeah, for about 5 years covering environment and agriculture.
Very cool. What brought you here?
Well, you know, I was actually looking to get out of journalism. I was going to go to grad school.
Okay.
I was hoping to move to London and do something entirely different, maybe something in science or just something different.
Okay.
I was questioning the longevity of how journalism could sustain my life.
Yeah.
Pay-wise, am I happy? All those kinds of
things. The travel,
yeah. You know. But then I'm going to be
honest here. Sorry to cut you off. The falling esteem of media and journalism in the eyes of the uneducated, right? I mean, it's a real, like, it used to be like you were a journalist, like that's, and I still think it's a cool job, but there's people out there that like the media is the enemy for some reason. Like, I don't even understand that, but it's a thing, right?
Yeah, there are people who think that. But for me, it wasn't about that. It was more, I was questioning whether I want to do it or not. And then I got the old environment reporter, Amy Quinton, left the station. She got another job. And then I got a call from the editor saying, hey, this position is opening. You know, I had sold a lot of stories to Capital Public Radio in the past, so they knew who I was. They knew I was covering environment. So I got recruited and I got the job. So then I moved up here. It was sort of perfect. My whole goal was to do two journalism jobs, feel it out. Is this good for me? Is this what I want to do with my life? I'm 31. You know, there's still time to make a career change, you know, those kind of things. So I got, and this was a great job, a statewide reporting job. I get to cover a myriad of environmental issues, other things as well, if they need it. So it was just kind of perfect.
Yeah.
You know, it was a good transition for me. I'll have like 10 of my best friends from college live here town.
Where'd you go to school?
Fresno State.
Cool, cool.
So there's a bunch of bulldogs up here, I guess, you know? So it was an easy transition. I came here and had an immediate peer group as well. So it just made sense financially, job-wise, and peer-wise, friend-wise. You know, and Sacramento's a pretty cool city.
Yeah, man, it's a great place, man. I have a hard time getting my family to visit because there's no like, my family from Mexico especially, man, they're so basic. They come every year and they go to Disneyland and they go back. Like, you guys have been to Disneyland, like, I'm not kidding, like 15, 20 times.
Yeah, I've been so many times. I don't even like it.
Yeah, like, you know, but they do it every, you know, and they keep having kids and you got to take the kids to Disneyland.
Well, I just think there's that stigma around the Central Valley still that, you know, it's like the armpit of California. It's all ag land and it's all farms and there's nothing cool happening here. But I'd say Sacramento is one of the cooler cities in the Central Valley, right? There's a lot going on here. There's the Midtown area that all the stuff is happening. Downtown is sort of moving. And then there's the Capitol, so you have this energy.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of city than in Fresno or Bakersfield or Redding, you know.
Oh, dude.
All
you know,
different.
I'm not gay, but let me tell you, the Lavender District knows how to party.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, it's just a cool district, man. The whole area around Lowbrow, Faces. You know, the Merc is probably one of the best places in town to get a drink.
Yeah, if you want a stiff drink.
If you want a stiff
drink. Stiff, cheap drink, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's where my friend, you know, that's where we start out, you know, because, yeah, you can get going for the rest of the night at the Merc for like $8.
Exactly, yeah, you can have two drinks for $8 and be effed up a bit.
Yeah, it's fun, you know, but it's a, and what I really like about Sacramento you know, and yourself sort of being interested in, you know, I would say public policy and reporting and sort of, you know, the world, is that it's a great town for people that give a damn, you know, because you might run into, you know, on your night out or socially, there might be someone in your friend group that's a toxicologist working on neonicotinoids, or who's working at the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or who's working on, you know, Kalanviro screen.
Yeah, 2.0. I mean, that's like my group. The other day I was out with my friends at the Merck, actually.
Yeah.
And my friends were, you know, I have a friend who works, he's a biologist, and he works in ethanol, and then I have another friend, he's an arborist, and then another friend, and she works for like the state emergency response group, and then there's me as a reporter, and then there's someone who's a waiter, you know. It was just like, and then there's someone who else works for like a gun lobby. It's like, it's a very diverse group of people.
Yeah.
It sort of reminds me of when I lived in DC for a little bit, but just like a smaller microcosm of that.
Yeah.
And also just a bit more chill.
Yeah. I heard DC's vicious, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's everyone's going for the big thing there, a big dream, you know? And
yeah.
It's just that East Coast thing, right? It's like it's that rat race in some ways. In California, you know, in DC and New York, like journalists wear suits wherever they go. In California, you don't have to do that. It's like, I'm not about that life.
Yeah, no, I'm not about that life either.
I do have a suit jacket that I have to carry around with me if I have to go cover the stuff in the Capitol.
Yeah.
But that's not my favorite thing.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like, why? The rat races, I dropped out. I mean, you know, I'm doing ESAC BJJ. I'm running this dojo now. You can actually sustain yourself. You know, if you get enough students, you can sustain yourself nicely, actually. That's not the reason I started training, but it's nice to be able to do something that you care about. Right.
Totally.
I see people sort of running that rat race that you talked about. I'm just like, oh, I don't know about that. You know, I don't know about that. what are some of your favorite places to hang out in town?
I bike a lot, so I bike on the American River Trail a lot from here to like Lake Natomas and back.
Nice.
And then I hang out in Lavender Heights a lot with my friends.
Yeah.
They go out, like the depot and places like that.
Very cool.
Where else? It's kind of it. I've been going to Tahoe and Desolation Wilderness a lot recently. It's really great. You know, I just went backpacking last week in Desolation for the weekend. Started at this place called Loon Lake and then went into the Desolation Wilderness. Did about 16 miles round trip, which is really cool.
On a hike?
Hike in and hike out.
Oof.
That was that last weekend.
You did that in a day or two? Or?
We left on a Friday night and then came back on a Sunday. So we, you know, hiked 4 miles in, camped, and then hiked another 4 miles the next day, and then had a whole the rest of the day just to chill, and then we hiked back out on Sunday, the rest of the 8 miles.
Yeah, that's cool. I want to do that, but then I also kind of don't. I'm like, oh my God, like all that walking, you know, but it's like the memories are beautiful.
Yeah. I try to I try to be pretty active. I don't actually have a TV or anything like that. So like
that's good.
I go out and do stuff with my friends. Like there's like free yoga classes on Tuesday and Thursdays at Fremont Park. I take those with my buddies. And then we just found some like great Taco Tuesday and Tostada Thursday places. So like some place to get like cheap, fun food, with friends and an excuse to hang out.
Yeah. The bartender at Azul looks like my dad.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Which I actually, upon reflection, I think was kind of a weird thing to tell him that he looks like my daddy. But this guy's like a spitting image of my dad, you know, and he starts jiving with me. Now we sort of talk in Spanish and he knows me. You know, we have good tacos here too. Moss Taco Bar is actually really
good. Yeah, it's pretty good. I've been there a bunch.
It's really good, you know, and that thing they do with like the Korean like duck confit, like the Korean like spongy bread.
Oh yeah, that was like the one I did not like.
You didn't like that one?
Yeah.
A little too much fusion for you?
I don't know. I just didn't like the texture. It was slimy.
Yeah, I got that.
Sorry, Moss Taco.
That's okay. That was the one taco.
Everything else was really good. There's some pork ones that were really good.
Yeah, yeah. I like that whole R Street corridor is so cool. I remember when I first got to SAC, there was like the Shady Lady and R15, and that was it. And then Bottle and Barlow is really cool. I don't know if you've been
there. I haven't been, no.
Yeah, Bottle and Barlow is really cool. They make excellent craft cocktails. And there's actually, like a lot of people don't know, but there's actually a balcony there. Although it's kind of tucked behind the bar, but you can kind of go up there and just kind of people watch all the folks.
Oh, that's
kind
cool.
Yeah.
It's on R Street?
Yeah, it's on R Street. It's like R and 10th, or, you know, it's just two blocks down. But yeah, a lot of folks just don't know. Like, if you walk around the bar, there's a staircase, and you can just kind of go up there and just kind of see the human parade, you know, and just kind of just kind of hang out.
I end up like going to the farmer's market on the weekend on J Street, you know, the one in Midtown.
And yeah.
Do a lot of outdoor stuff and hang out with my boyfriend at home.
Yeah.
Just chill. You know, when I first moved here, I was going pretty hard, hanging out all the time, doing, you know.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
Well,
just
you want to establish your peer group.
Establish, you know, I heard all my friends were doing this, so I went out a bunch and I finally slowed down. I was like, this is not sustainable.
Yeah.
You know. So, and it's like, you know, it's a bit more fun to like balance it out and do different things, like explore different parts of the city. And
yeah. Well, 31, you know, your 30s start catching up to you. We're both the same age. We're both 31, right? And it's like, you know, sometimes I'll have two drinks and I'll be like, oh my God. Like,
exactly.
You know, hey, so what are some of the, just looking back on your career as an environmental reporter, what are some of the stories that have most interested in you? And what are some of the things going on right now that you think, that are most interesting to you and also, you know, maybe aren't being covered enough and need more attention?
Sure. So I've covered everything from giant sequoias and the drought and climate change affecting them, which is some of the most interesting stories. Like, we've able to like go up on these long hikes and like talk to the scientists who are scaling the trees and things like that. Covered everything from that to how, you know, climate change is affecting farms and how farmers, even though, you know, a lot of them may be conservative, and a lot of conservative farmers don't say they don't believe in climate change and things like that, right? Or that's a popular view of them.
Yeah.
But actually, they're adjusting their lives. They're adjusting their farms, taking into the fact that warming temperatures are happening. You know, they may not call it climate change or something like that, but they are dealing with it, you know? And so I've loved telling those stories. Now my summer's been Yosemite Land, right?
Yeah.
But before that here, I told a lot of stories about the nexus of agriculture and the environment. For example, there's like some rice fields north of town where they're letting water in and they're letting all these bugs grow in it and they release it to feed salmon. So there's all these trial projects about that kind of stuff. At the moment, moving forward, I want to cover more climate change stuff. There's the big climate change summit that Governor Brown putting on in the Bay. We'll be covering that. There's like the whole water fix discussion about like the Delta, the tunnels and things like that, which is not my favorite thing to cover. I think it's the minutia of it's actually quite boring, but it could have great ramifications for the state.
Absolutely.
Right. So the whole trick is, as a radio journalist, is to cover that in a way that's interesting, right? It might work for a print article, but for a radio article, it might just be, for a long form one, could be boring. So I have to figure out a way to tell that in an interesting way, you know, to get the listener's attention, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, this is important. And
Yeah.
So those are some things I'm going to be focusing on. I also want to tell, so there's all this discussion about wildfire and solutions and all this, you know, in the at the Capitol, they're talking about these possible solutions, and there's all this discourse about that, right? And there's all these areas, all these groups that are invested in different ways, right?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about that stuff too, and like, what are these actual solutions? What does it actually mean for prescribed burns? What does it mean for X, Y, and Z?
Yeah.
And is that feasible on the large scale?
Yeah. I mean, the wildfire thing is just super interesting. Who's liable? Who, you know, even if you are liable, like, are you going to ultimately pass that cost on to consumers?
Totally.
What are the right environmental solutions? I don't know enough to say, but it does seem to me that there is at least a vocal minority of folks out there saying, like, hey, you know, we're not able to clear out brush. You know, the old timber industry, which is, you know, no longer really present in California, used to actually do us some good in terms of clearing out this brush and clearing out these hillsides. You know, if we're not going to let these fires burn, then we got to clear out dead brush. Otherwise, we just have these tinder boxes lighting up.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting to me how those discussions get couched politically so quickly. You know, where you start saying, "Hey, you know, as a rancher or as a Californian, I'm concerned that we're not clearing out this brush," and people immediately say, "Like, well, you're just trying to bring back the timber industry." Well, you know, maybe they were doing us some good. You know, who knows? I don't know enough to really evaluate that claim, but it seems like we've done something wrong, right? Like we're on the wrong end of all these fires, and there's no relief in sight. You know, climate change certainly has something to do with it, but we used to, you know, like fires are also necessary, as you said, in your assembly line. Fires are necessary to clear this stuff out. And if it's not going to get cleared out, then you're going to get one big fire at the end. You know, it's like, what are you going to do, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to take a myriad of solutions, and it's not just one or the other. And I don't know. So we're going to, I hope to discover, talk about that a bit.
Yeah.
You know, get away from like the political minutiae of it all and talk about the greater, larger solutions. You know, what can actually be done, and, you know, will it work?
Yeah. Do you feel like there's anything out there that isn't getting the attention it deserves? Like environmental wise?
I think as an environmental reporter, there's just so much to cover, right? Yeah. There's one of me to cover everything. There's everything from all the stuff happening with like offshore drilling to, you know, the water fix stuff to, I don't know, just so much. I can't actually think about what should be covered. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. You know, I wanted to touch a little bit on what you said about these farmers, because a lot of them are, you know, a little bit more conservative. But they all have Mexicans picking their grapes, and they all have, I mean, like the intersection of farmers and the necessity for, you know, you can't be super political as a journalist, and I get that, but you know, I'll just go out and say it. Like a lot of these farmers, like I think, could actually be turned onto like progressive policies. It's like they need immigration to pick their, you know, for their fields. They need the labor of immigration. They just do, you know, and they're being hit hard by climate change, whether they want to believe it or not. Like a lot of farmers are scientists, you know, or they respond to science.
Well, they're calculated, you know, they have to be, because this is their livelihood. And so they'd be dumb not to understand that something's happening to their fields and they're trying to mitigate that. Right. So they're like, it's their livelihood. This field of alfalfa or oranges or nectarines or peaches, they got to make that sustain, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought that there was like maybe some sort of like there for the Democrats to like talk, you know, make a concerted effort at talking to, you know, farmers in the Valley and farmers across America, and really be like, hey, you know, like, are your interests really being reflected in ignoring climate science? Are your interests really being reflected in, you know, cutting off, you know, immigrant labor? No, they're probably not, actually, you know, but a lot of those voting patterns are more in the gut than they are in the mind, I think, you know, which is too bad. But I mean, you know, with anything, it's a lot of it's more in the gut than it is in the mind, you know?
Sure.
We are, and you touched on this with the farmers too, is like, you know, if they might not want to accept the truth of climate change, we're sort of like increasingly kind of delving into, you know, this sort of post-truth era where, you know, at the highest levels of our government, you have officials who just say, like, even Rudy Giuliani just, you know, just said, well, truth is in the eye of the beholder. You know, Kellyanne Conway saying alternative facts, the president saying a lie a minute, seemingly. And, you know, this idea that, like, you can kind of curate your news now. You can kind of curate, whether it's Breitbart or InfoWars or, you know, I mean, on the left, we have some, you know, there's some publications on the left that'll tell you whatever you want to hear, you know, and you have like these hyper-politicized voices on both sides kind of crowding out the truth, you know, and, you know, for you, I mean, you're reporting on environmental science, you're reporting on facts. How does that make your job more difficult? Or, you know, what do you think about this sort of?
I think for us, for me in the station, it's just like, we're just going to keep reporting the truth. You know, it's like in every story we write, I'm going to try to get both sides. I'm going to try to, you know, if there's a story about how climate change is affecting farms, I'm going to talk to the farmers, I'm going to talk to the scientists, and they may agree or not agree, right? But I'm going to include both of their voices. And that's all I think all we can do, really, is just be honest about our process and just do it. And if there's people who complain about that, I don't know what to say. You know, I'm always going to report both sides and say if one side didn't want to say anything, you know, that's all I can do.
Yeah. So the answer is just more reporting, just more.
Yeah, truth. I think so. I just think you just keep trucking along. You just keep going.
Yeah. In your view,
I don't even like to engage in that kind of conversation about, like, you know, about fake news and things. It's like, I'm just going to report the truth about what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
And if someone deems that as fake, then contact our sources.
Yeah. That's on them.
Yeah.
In your view, do we get out of this arc? Do we correct? Or what happens?
I don't know. I think there is a lot of news out there. There are a lot of places to get news. I think you just have to pay attention where it's coming from and actually look at the sources. I think it can come from one of these right-wing places or left-wing things that might just tell you one thing, but I think you have to look into the reporting, look who is saying it, you know, like, look who their sources are and look into that. Like, if it's all one person in one story, you can kind of tell that it's not it's biased, right? It's not unbiased. So, like, in all my reporting, I just want to include as many voices as I can, you know, on both sides. Yeah. And so, to stay unbiased.
Yeah, very cool.
That's not always possible if someone doesn't want to talk to you. Because we also have time frames and deadlines and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So, you just do your best.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about sort of like, can journalism sustain you? You know, so both my parents are journalists or war journalists.
Okay.
Yeah. They met in the newsroom.
Wow.
Yeah. Mexican Channel 12. I think my dad was holding the camera for my mom. She was like the Cambie Brown of Tijuana. You know, she was like, you know, reporting on the scene.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, we were always raised like, you know, reading the newspaper, like, you know. Probably one of the biggest gifts that they gave to me is like, well, what do you think about this, Gibran? You know, I was like, you know, 5, 6 years old. What do you think about this? But slowly but surely, kind of one by one, they all kind of made it out of journalism. My dad is actually the editor, the publishing editor for Los Angeles Hoy and the LA Times in Español.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So he's still at it. But, you know, we've all seen sort of like the decimation of the industry and sort of like the crowding out of the industry by people that'll just tell you what you want to hear, you know? So just asking you to sort of reflect a little bit, it's like, is, you know, does grad school still call your name? Like, what are your next steps? I mean, it seems like you're enjoying yourself in town here. It seems like you get to do a lot of meaningful work.
Yeah. I think there's something with working in the public radio world. We're not necessarily, I had this conversation with someone earlier this week about, you know, is it about clicks for you guys? I know, like, some stations and some newsrooms, they plaster how many clicks or views your stories are getting.
That is not a good thing to do.
Yeah, and so our station isn't about that. As a public radio station, we're all about telling the stories that we think are meaningful, that are going to go the distance, that are or things that need to be highlighted, and maybe they're not going to get 30,000 listens or views or more, you know, but maybe they're going to, but maybe we just think it's worthwhile to cover. And so I think that's why I like public radio. We get to cover stories that we think are meaningful.
Yeah.
And we don't necessarily have to cover every like moment of the day, every news story, right? So I don't know if I fully answered your question.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I guess just, you know, for you is like, I thought it was interesting. You said you wanted to do something in science.
Yeah, I think because I was a geography minor, so I learned about a bunch of science in college, and then I started covering science and agriculture and environmental stuff. And so to be on the other side of the research, you know, creating the research, living somewhere for a long time, maybe doing something where pay is a bit more, things like that.
Yeah.
I'm in a good place right now in my career, my job, and I'm not looking to go to grad school anytime soon. I want to be in this for a bit and see what life is like in this role. And then after a year, 2 years, 3 years, reevaluate.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's...
I mean, it makes sense, right? You're always around all these scientists and you're always around sort of like the research of it, you know, and the facts. It makes sense that you would sort of...
Yeah. And, you know, as like, as you, you know, if I ever get a partner or anything like that in my life, like...
Yeah.
It could be easier to have a different kind of job, right?
Oh, yeah.
If they want to go somewhere or do something else. You know, in journalism, you're kind of tied to where you can get a job also, right? Like, so it just depends. I mean, it might be another good tool in my tool bag, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'll make an analogy here with the dojo, you know. Love teaching. My competitive spirit has sort of waned, and then, you know, I'll still get in there and compete. I might take an MMA fight next year. I just think it's fun, you know. But I've always had a passion for teaching. But teaching's a grind, man, let me tell you. Did you ever watch Lost?
Mm-mm.
Oh, well, there's this trope in Lost where they have to, like, go to a computer and punch in this code, or the island that they're on blows up.
Okay.
And it's like every 18 or 20 minutes they have to do that. And at first, when they introduce the trope, it doesn't seem that onerous. But then over time, you realize, like, oh, it means you can't get good sleep. Oh, it means you can't hunt on the other side of the island. It means you can't really venture very far because you have to be back every 20 minutes for this thing. And teaching is like, you know, you teach 6 days a week. You got a 6 a.m. class, you got a 6 p.m. class, you got a class in the middle at noon, and then you teach on Saturdays. And it's like, okay, well, when is your 3 day week at? You know, when's your time
off?
Exactly,
yeah.
You know? So now my wife is like, okay, well, maybe I'll take a Monday off and we can do Saturday afternoon, Sunday, and Monday off. Okay, cool, we'll get out of town, you know? But it's that same thing where it's like, all right, you're kind of, or if something happens, right? I mean, if something, you know, if Orville Dam collapses or, you know, God forbid, you're running to the scene, right?
Yeah, there are certain things that if this happens or, you know, if there's a big fire in our coverage area that's, you know, it's affecting people's lives, I'm going to go cover it.
Yeah.
You know, I think fires are probably one of the most boring things to cover.
Because really?
It's the same thing.
Another fire.
It's, you know, it's like disaster journalism in some ways. It's the same thing no matter what fire it is. You know, it's the same kind of reporting. So it's not my favorite. I do it.
Yeah.
It's part of the job. And sometimes it's really interesting. Most of the time it's about the same.
Yeah. No, I get that.
You know.
And the only thing more boring than covering it is like, to people, I think it's like, hey, talking about the policy solutions and really digging down. It's like, gosh, I wish we could get more attention to like what to do about it, right?
But yeah, but people, you know, it's like we live in this world where you have to have those policy solution kind of conversations because that's how our government works and that's how funding works, and you have to convince lawmakers and, you know, industry leaders that this is the way to go. And so it takes a lot of conversation to do that. But for the average person to care about that, you have to put it in a way that they can understand it and think, oh, why is this? Why is burning the forest on purpose important, or why should it be, or is it at all? You know.
Yeah.
So, I think as a journalist, my whole role is I want to go beyond those policy conversations and come talk about a solution that people can understand that can make those policy ideas come to life.
Yeah.
To make them beyond a whole story about, you know, the back and forth of legislators.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think meeting people where they're at is really one of the public services that you do and that public radio does really well. You know, go to the Capitol, go to a legislator's office and ask for a fact sheet on a bill. It's written for other staffers. You know, it's like, well, this such and such code section does this and this and this. And like, it's written for other people that are already in the know, you know, it's not written for an external audience. And, you know, I always had this like, this view in my mind of like, hey, could we do a better job than just talking to each other? You know, could we sort of talk outwardly instead of inwardly, you know? But I guess not, because those fact sheets are still being written the same way. You know, they're still written for internal
audiences. And our whole job is to like interpret that for our audience, right?
Yeah.
If I'm doing a daily story that has to be a minute long, I want to like, you have to highlight the bill, but you also want to just make it really real. So my whole job is to translate that in a way for the public that is understandable and interesting. And, oh, that's why I should care about this bill passing in this way or it going this way in this assembly committee or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You said fires aren't particularly one of your favorite things to cover. I feel the same way. I'll kind of liken it to like a tragedy, like a shooting where it's like, oh, another shooting. Oh, another fire. You know, it's a tragedy. What can we do about it? Who knows?
Yeah. It can become that way. Right.
Yeah.
I've been covering fire and drought for 6 years now. And, it's a similar story every summer, you know?
What are some of your favorite stories to cover? What do you think is like particularly interesting?
I love environmental stories that have to do with, I don't know, solutions or change or a lot of times like climate change stories.
Yeah.
You can find these niche type stories that are interesting, that bring to life some of this, like some positive stories too.
Yeah. Not just bad news.
You know, I think one of my favorite stories I covered was about this group that wants to bring grizzly bears back to California.
Fuck yeah.
You know, bring them back. So, yeah, maybe not. I don't know. That was a great story to report, and I saw that one on Twitter, and then I ended up going out with a bear biologist, and while we were out, we ended up trapping a bear.
Oh, my goodness.
Relocating it, because it just happened to happen while we were out reporting. So I love those kinds of stories where the story is like this greater, larger idea of something that could happen. And then the story kind of takes on a life of its own. I think those are the best for me as a radio journalist, where the scene all of a sudden unfolds itself, and it's sort of like reporter's luck in some way.
Yeah.
That this thing happened while I was out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love covering stories in the Sierra Nevada. I'm a mountain guy, so the more often I can be on a river or in the mountains or things like that, the better.
Yeah. Yeah. Rivers in particular, man. What a unique view of the city.
Yeah.
You know, my wife and I got a boat at the beginning of the summer. It was her idea. I kept telling her, you know, the B in boat stands for big hassle. And it is, you know, we got to change the oil, you know, the barnacles get, well, not barnacles, but like algae gets stuck to it. You have to pull the boat out. I don't know how to drive a trailer, and neither does she. I mean, and it's expensive, so you don't want to like crash it on the trailer. But nonetheless, you know, we got the boat despite everyone's counsel. It's a lot of fun, though. Let me tell you, it's a lot of fun.
Well, there's a lot of riverways around here.
So yeah.
You can see those, and you, unless you have a boat, you can't really explore them.
Yeah, yeah. And let me tell you, man, they'll recontextualize the homeless issue for you. You know, because we go up to, we're docked at the Sac Marina, and we go up to the confluence of the Sacramento and the Marina rivers and American rivers. And just in that mile and a half, you'll pass up, you know, 20 people, you know, living by the river, you know, with like clothes hung out to dry, you know, maybe making food, maybe one person's just got trash everywhere, you know, and then people like actually like sustaining themselves, like with a livelihood, you know, kind of like fishing all day, you know, I mean, just this whole area of Sacramento that like this whole, that you wouldn't even like get a sense to know about, you know what I mean? If it wasn't for kind of,
being able to see it from the river. Yeah, I want to write a story about like the environmental effects, the environmental impact of homelessness, or, you know, a person going through homelessness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was, you know, just cruising through the river, you know, you see, you know, person's got their whole spread out. They got everything they own out, you know, and it's clear that they're living there, and your heart aches for them a little bit. And then you also say to yourself, man, I think they're also going to the bathroom in the river, you know, and like those impacts, like, if it's one person, okay, maybe not a huge impact for a big river, but hey, what if it's 1,000 people? You know, I mean, it's a problem, man. You know,
totally.
Well, hey, we're coming up on an hour here, so I think it's probably a good time to wrap up and let you get out of here and let you get on with the rest of your day. Sincerely appreciate you coming on. Where can people follow you on Twitter and kind of get a hold of Yosemite Land and
yeah, sort of just connect with Twitter you? Yeah, so my Twitter is just @EzraRomero.
Okay.
You can also find Yosemite Land at capradio.org/YosemiteLand. We have a website where you can look at photos and maps, and you can also email me if you have questions, things like that there. Or you can listen to Yosemite Land wherever you listen to podcasts, on Apple Podcasts or Google or Stitcher, anywhere like that.
Very cool. Thanks for joining for another talk with Ezra Romero, one of the original gangsters of environmental reporting in the Valley.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks again, brother.